You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, I hope you are holding up well in this quarantine that we're all in. I hope you guys are writing every single day. I know it's tough. I know we're going through a lot, but this is an opportunity for you to stretch as a writer, to work on your craft, to educate yourself, take online courses, read books, read screenplays, analyze films, work on your craft. Take advantage of this time, guys. And today's guest is going to help you write your complete screenplay in 90 days. Today's guest is Alan Watt, who is a screenwriter and award-winning author. He's also the founder of the LA Writers Lab, and his book, The 90-Day Screenplay, will lay out the blueprint for you to be able to write your entire screenplay in 90 days from concept all the way to final draft. Now, I really love this conversation with Alan because we go deep into the weeds on not only his method of the 90-day screenplay, which, by the way, I found to be really well done, really well put together. It's a great blueprint to get your work done and get your screenplay done. But we also go deep into the weeds on character, on structure, heavily on structure today, and plot, and kind of debunking some myths in regards to structure and how many acts you're supposed to have and what you're supposed to do here and there. You know, Alan really breaks it down to the core, to the raw, exposed meat, if you will, of what a story really needs to be. It is a fascinating conversation. I can't wait for you guys to get into it. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Alan Watt. I'd like to welcome to the show Alan Watt, man. Thank you so much for being on the show, brother.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, we're hanging in there in the quarantine, aren't we?
We sure are. Yeah, 4 weeks in.
Yeah,
it could go on forever.
Yeah, I don't know when it's going to stop, but at least, you know, for writers, they have now they have no excuses. They're locked in and they have to write.
You know, in theory, that's true, and yet I talk to my writers and they're all so freaked out. You know, we got to remember we're also artists, and
yeah.
When we're freaked out, we got to factor that in and know that it's challenging. I get so many writers say, I've got all day to write and I'm still struggling. So I think it's important to get your writing done before you watch the news.
Without question. So less Tiger King and more Final Draft is
what
you're
saying. That's right. Yeah. Get up, take a leak, start writing, and then check your emails and watch the news. But get the writing done first, because that's when you're fresh. That's when your imagination is firing.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so before we get started, how did you get your start in the business?
Well, I started as a stand-up comic in Canada. And I did comedy for a long time, and I moved to New York, and then some managers brought me out to Los Angeles many years ago, and then stand-up was going well, and then I wrote a novel, and it got auctioned for a ridiculous amount of money, and I didn't have to go on the road anymore, so I just focused. I'd always been writing screenplays, but that's when I really focused more on novels and screenplays. And then I started when I wasn't going on the road anymore. I started LA Writers Lab about 19 years ago.
Oh, wow. So it's been around for a minute.
I started teaching. My first class was, somebody asked me to teach a summer screenwriting class at UCLA mm-hmm. in 98. And I loved it. I just loved it. And I was always giving notes to all my screenwriter friends. And then I just kind of opened the doors on LA Writers Lab in a really small way in about 19 years ago.
Very cool. Yeah. And you wrote a book, a really good best-selling book called The 90 Day Screenplay. So I have to ask you the question. How do you write a 90 Day Screenplay?
Yes. Well, yeah, let's get into that. Yeah, I wrote the 90 day novel, the 90 day screenplay, the 90 day rewrite, and so, yeah, let's talk about it. The 90 day screenplay is a process of writing basically the first month is outlining your screenplay. So we spend a full month allowing the outline to emerge, and then we spend the second month writing the first draft. And then we spend the last five or so weeks polishing the first draft. So that's broken up into three sections.
So that's the basic. Let's get into the first part, the outline. I know a lot of filmmakers and a lot of screenwriters, they tend, I've heard this complaint, this objection is like, I don't outline. I just let the thing free flow, man. I'm an artist. I just got to see when inspiration hits me. I just got to see where the story takes me and where the characters are talking to me and all that stuff. And to a certain extent, I get that, but I've always been an outliner. I'd love to hear your point of view on the outline, the importance of it and why you believe it to be such an integral part of this process.
Okay, I understand why people say that, and it's because screenwriting is so often taught by story analysts mm-hmm. who aren't really screenwriters themselves. And so it's taught – so a lot of artists rightfully hear outlining or story structure as some kind of a formula, and it's not. Story structure is the DNA of your protagonist's transformation. And so – what I'm teaching is a process of marrying the wildness of your imagination to the rigor of story structure. But you have to be doing both concurrently. Okay, and so oftentimes story structure is taught as this formula. And so understandably, an artist is going to recoil at that idea. But there's a process of outlining that allows the wildness of your imagination to run free. So you're not outlining isn't figure. It's not a left brain process. You're not figuring out your story like it's a math problem. Mm-hmm. That's not outlining. I don't know what that is, but that's a guaranteed way to get stuck. Einstein says you can't solve a problem at the same level of consciousness that created the problem. In other words, he's talking about. Let me back up. The purpose of story is to reveal a transformation. And so we can't figure our way out to a transformation, which is what Einstein is saying. You can't figure your way out to the solution to a problem. Every protagonist begins with a dramatic problem. They got this problem that they think needs to be solved. But what they're going to discover over the course of the story is that what they're actually struggling with is not a problem. For example, Jimmy Stewart wants to leave Bedford Falls so he can have a wonderful life. He thinks his problem is, how do I get out of Bedford Falls? What he discovers is that he doesn't have a problem. He never had to leave Bedford Falls. What he discovers is that he's got a dilemma. And his dilemma is that as long as I believe that a wonderful life lives outside of Bedford Falls, I'll forever be in bondage to my limited idea, as Einstein says, of my problem. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Okay. And so the reason it's, you know, I want to ask people out there, have you ever written a screenplay that you didn't outline and you felt like it did everything that you wanted it to do? I think the answer is usually no. And I think also sometimes we hear about those screenwriters that claim not to outline. And we think, well, Charlie Kaufman says he doesn't outline. Woody Allen says he doesn't outline. But the truth is, these guys have been writing for years and they have mastered their craft. And so they, while they may not be writing their outline down, I've talked to a number of writers about this who are really successful. And they go, well, I used to outline, but now outlining is second nature, or I have the outline in my head, but I don't write it down. So they don't call it outlining. But I think it's a real misnomer to suggest, especially to novice screenwriters, that not outlining is going to give you a really satisfying story where the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts. It's just not going to happen. But what's also not going to happen is if you go to some screenwriting class where you're being taught by a story analyst who's teaching you some kind of formula and you're expected to adapt to their formula, that's not going to work either. And so what you've got to do is you've got to find a process of marrying the wildness of your imagination to the rigorous story structure. And that's what I'm teaching in the 90-day screenplay.
Is it so it's the equivalence of me going, I'm going to go build a house, but I don't want a blueprint right now. I'm just going to start throwing up walls and I can only see the four walls that I've put up right now, but I don't see it as a whole of the house that I'm trying to build. But if I would, but if I had that blueprint, the architectural blueprints, I'm like, okay, I could put this house here and I can decorate those walls however I want. I can put the window wherever I want. I can put the door wherever I want, but you still need to know where it's all going and how it's all going to work together to form the final house. That makes sense?
Well, here's the problem with that analogy. The problem with that analogy is it suggests that a screenplay is a house. But it's not. A screenplay, the character, the protagonist, and the house are inextricably linked. So character is structure. And that's why people hear that house analogy. I've heard it before. And they go, so I don't know how to build the house. You're not supposed to know how to build the house. Einstein, again, says you can't solve the problem at the same level of consciousness as the creator of the problem. So let me explain a little bit about what I'm teaching. Is that all these books on story structure talk about the dramatic problem. But the truth is that your protagonist doesn't have a problem. They have a dilemma, and there's a difference. Problems are solved. They're intellectual. Okay? They're intellectual. You can't solve the problem at the same level of consciousness that created. Dilemmas are resolved through a shift in perception. What your protagonist has is a dilemma, not a problem. Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life has a dilemma. The dilemma is there are two ingredients to a dilemma: a powerful desire, I want to leave Bedford Falls, and a false belief. Leaving Bedford Falls is what will give me a wonderful life. Okay, two ingredients to a dilemma: powerful desire and a false belief. When you understand, when you connect to your protagonist's dilemma, you are connecting to the source of your story. Okay. What we really care about in your story is your theme. The plot is the vehicle that carries the theme. Okay, and so your theme is explored through this dilemma. I always say, you know you've got a story when what your protagonist wants is impossible to achieve based on their current approach or their current identity. Okay, Jimmy Stewart has to die to his old identity in order to be reborn. Okay. In other words, you can't have a transformation without there first being a surrender, a dark night of the soul at the end of the second act.
So okay. All right. So then, so you're talking about, you just said acts. There's a lot of miscommunication about what an actual story, you know, the three act structure, the five act structure, the seven act structure. There's so many different kind of structures. Can you discuss some? I mean, obviously we all know the three act structure is like the big, the one that is, yeah, is, but can you talk a little bit about those? Cause I know that's confusing to a lot of people.
Yes. Okay. Well, when I hear five act structure, I'm hearing like a 1 hour, TV. Okay. And they break it up into a teaser typically in four acts or a teaser in five acts. But those acts are they've been designed for in order to have television commercials. So those aren't story acts. Those are just acts that were created by studio executives so that they could sell advertising space. The three act structure is for feature films, and it's for a story. And mm-hmm. and I you know, the big thing you hear now, you hear some of these writers who sort of want to be progressive, or and they talk about how the three act structure is sort of dead, or that the three act structure is only one kind of structure. Mm-hmm. However, and my radar has been up on this for years. They never tell you the other structures. Have you ever heard them? Mm. There's other structures. The three act structure is old. It's only for novices. I've heard so many of these writing gurus talk about this, but I have never heard them in a really sort of granular way talk about the other structures, because I'm dying to hear what they are.
Well, real quickly.
Let me say one other.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the three act structure is not a formula. And so when I hear these story analysts talk about the three act structure is not the only other structure, they're not understanding that the three act structure can be distilled to three words: desire, surrender, transformation. That's the three act structure. Okay. Your protagonist wants something. The stakes are life and death. If I don't get blank, my life will be unimaginable. By the end of act two, your protagonist surrenders the meaning they made out of their goal. Okay. The meaning they made out of their goal, not their goal. And they let go. And in letting go, they reframe their relationship to their goal, and they accept the reality of their situation as opposed to the appearance of their situation. And that allows them in the third act to pursue what they need as opposed to what they want. And that leads to a battle scene, which is oftentimes an internal battle that may manifest itself externally, but it's a battle scene where they make a difficult choice between what they want and what they need. And that leads to the new equilibrium. You give me any screenplay that works, and I will show you that structure.
Well, but so when you hear some of these the old Greek plays and things like that have four acts or five acts or things like that, how is that different? And I mean, I've heard someone talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark having five acts as opposed to a three act.
Yeah. Okay. But what I'm talking about is the DNA. I'm talking about, so they can be broken up into four acts, five acts. Shakespeare, a lot of his plays were five acts, mm-hmm. but Romeo and Juliet, if you break it down, it's not a three act play, mm-hmm. but the story is the most traditional three act structure. You know, Romeo, the inciting incident is Romeo sees Juliet through the window. The opposing argument is Romeo discovers that Juliet is the enemy of his father's father, an enemy of his father. The end of Act One, Romeo makes a decision that he can't go back on to profess his love to Juliet. And but he's reluctant because he's afraid that her father will kill him. OK, and then the Dark Night of the Soul is that Romeo realizes that it's impossible to have Juliet based on his current approach. Mm. Okay. And so that leads to him accepting the reality of his situation, which is that they are doomed lovers. And that leads to the difficult choice where he, takes the, can't remember what the poison is. Mm-hmm. Remember the poison?
I don't remember the name of the poison, but he took poison. Yeah.
Drinks the, I'm blanking on it. But he makes the difficult choice. I want to be with my love for eternity, and so he kills himself.
I mean, spoiler alert. I mean, come on.
This is where people get into, they misunderstand the semantics, and sure. they confuse the way a script has been broken up into pieces with the DNA of the protagonist's journey. So you can easily break up any screenplay into four parts, because act two is typically twice as long as act one and act three. You can call your screenplay four acts. Mm-hmm. It's not going to change a word of your screenplay to call it four acts. You can break it up into five acts if you want.
Got it. It's semantics. At the end of the day, it's still 3 points.
If one doesn't master story structure, and it's three act structure. If you don't master that, if you don't, then you're really going to struggle with writing a compelling screenplay.
So let's talk a little bit about character, because a character is something that when we see a bad, it's like we don't know a good one till we see it, and we don't know a bad one till we see it. It's hard to explain,
right.
But like, you know, you watch some of these amazing characters like an Indiana Jones, like a Luke Skywalker,
yeah.
like a Darth Vader as a protagonist or an antagonist. And you see these guys, but when you see some of these bad movies, you're just like, oh God, that's so blah. This guy has like no this, or this girl has no that. It's like, what makes, right. in your opinion, a really good character, and how can we, any tips on writing a more compelling character?
Okay, first of all, we got to let go of this idea that character has to be likable. The mm-hmm. character has to want something really bad, and that's going to make us care about them.
Mm-hmm.
If we understand the circumstance that they're in, there will be we're going to care about them. My first novel, Diamond Dogs, the main character, the protagonist, accidentally kills somebody on the highway in the opening chapter, or the second chapter. And I'm told people really care about him. It was a bestseller. We're making it into a movie. But the point is that the character isn't necessarily likable,
mm-hmm.
but we mm-hmm. understand his relationship with his father. We understand the circumstances that led him to this accident. And so hopefully we care about him. So what I want to say is you've got to have a protagonist that wants something. The stakes have to be life and death. I don't mean literally life and death. I mean, if Jan Brady doesn't get a date with Tad Hamilton, she will absolutely die. You see what I mean? I have to get this, or my life will be unimaginable. That's life and death. The character wants something. The stakes are high. And then at some point, the protagonist is going to – let me walk you through just like the really primitive, necessary stages in every protagonist's journey,
mm-hmm.
okay, in every three action, is that your protagonist is going to have – there's going to be an inciting incident, okay? Something happens that sets the story into motion. It's the moment where the audience collectively goes, oh, this is what the story's about.
Mm-hmm.
Romeo sees Juliet through the window. Oh, this is what the story's about. And then there's got to be a decision at the end of the first act. That decision needs to be coupled with reluctance. Why? Because the reluctance keeps us connected to the protagonist's dilemma. Okay, dilemma is tension. Dilemma feels like I'm being pulled in two different directions at the same time. You can feel it. It's an experience. And so our protagonist makes it reluctance doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean I don't really want to do this. The reluctance means that we understand what it will mean if they don't do it. Okay, I've got to do this. In other words, you know, if Luke Skywalker he gets on, you know, the ship, but he looks back and there's his farm burning and his aunt and uncle are dying. Okay, he's reluctant to leave, but what does he want? He wants to go and be a starfighter, right? So he's not reluctant to be a starfighter. He's reluctant to say goodbye to the status quo, to mm-hmm. his old life.
Mm-hmm.
Don't confuse reluctance with indifference. Otherwise, it's going to kill the aliveness of your screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
The next major, really big point is the midpoint. A lot of screenwriters, I hear this word, it drives me nuts because it's an intellectual word. They call it the reversal. if you try and figure out, I can't figure out a reversal in the middle of my story, but think in terms of experiences. I teach story structure as an experiential model. A lot of teachers teach it as a conceptual model. But if you think in terms of experience, you're going to realize that character suggests plot. So your character's experience is going to lead to an event happening. So think in terms of the experience of temptation. In the middle of your screenplay, your protagonist is going to experience temptation. I made some notes and I thought we were going to do this today. So I'm reverting back to some of the old, in Rocky. Mm-hmm. Everybody's seen the movie Rocky. Rocky is offered to fight the heavyweight champion of the world. Mm-hmm. What is he? That's the midpoint of the movie.
Yeah, it is. What actually, you're right. Yeah,
it's midpoint. No, 57 minutes.
No way. No, I'm good.
No, he says no, and Juergens says this is the chance of a lifetime. Don't pass it by. And then we cut to him on the screen with Apollo Creed. Then he says yes. If he doesn't say no, there's no context for the yes. And It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart is offered to work for Mr. Potter. Okay, if you're writing a screenplay and I always say our idea of our screenplay is never the whole story. It's not that it's incorrect, it's that it's incomplete. If you are writing your idea of a guy trying to leave Bedford Falls, it might never occur to you to have the devil, Mr. Potter, offer him a job. But what's happened is that he's become so successful with the savings and loan that the devil does offer him a job. So in other words, if you think in terms of your protagonist experiencing temptation, it might occur to you, oh, what would tempt him? What if the devil offered him a job? So this way of working is a way of moving you beyond your limited idea of your screenplay and stretching your imagination. Story structure, if you explore it as an experiential model, you're going to start to invest yourself into it. You're going to have some skin in the game. You're not just going to be trying to figure it out from your prefrontal cortex.
So with protagonists, generally speaking, everything that you've said makes absolute sense. There's a transformation from the beginning to the end. But there's two characters and one specific kind of story that doesn't kind of fit the transformation because the main character doesn't change, which is the detective story or like the original James Bond stories where James Bond is absolutely no transformation whatsoever, but everybody around him transforms. And same thing for the detective story. How does that work with the detective story?
Okay, good. I'm glad you brought that up. So in Cautionary Tales, for example, in a Cautionary Tale, the transformation can be for the audience. So in other words, the purpose of story is to reveal a transformation. The transformation doesn't necessarily have to be for the hero. In a cautionary tale, it's not. In a cautionary tale, they're led to this difficult choice between what they want and what they need, and they choose what they want. Okay? As Judas lays dying, he still sees the error of his ways. Okay? And so I'm remembering, I don't know why, but Carlito's Way. It's like he dies at the, you know, as he's getting on the train, he's trying to get away and he realizes it was too late. I got hung up with my ego. And so don't confuse transformation with a happy ending. It's not necessarily. Transformation is simply it is simply a shift in perception. It's seeing the situation in a new way. And so you think about Goodfellas, the transformation is when we realize that, oh, look, crime doesn't pay. You know, the theme always comes full circle. So it doesn't mean that it's always happy ending.
Yeah. So like if you look at like Sherlock Holmes, you know, like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's stories, I mean, they're so wonderfully written. And Sherlock is obviously one of the greatest characters ever developed or constructed. But Sherlock, from the beginning of any of his stories, he's Sherlock. He rarely ever does change. And specifically James Bond, those early Sean Connerys and Roger Moore, he was just the womanizing guy who does this. The only time that changes when Daniel Craig showed up, and that's when I felt that they gave such depth to him, and then James Bond actually transformed, and that's what made Casino Royale such an amazing Bond film. But those early movies worked, and those early moved for what they were. So what would you – like how would you say the transformation was in a Sherlock Holmes story or a James Bond story?
So and I haven't read Sherlock Holmes in years.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
What's his sidekick's name?
Holmes. Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes and Watson.
Okay. So, it's possible that Watson is the protagonist. Mm-hmm. He's not the protagonist. Let me take that back. But Watson is the lens through which the audience sees the story. Mm-hmm. And so Watson can be the one who has the transformation. Mm-hmm. Is that he can be the one who's sort of watching Holmes with admiration, perhaps confusion, judgment, and then by the end of the story, understand something, because Sherlock Holmes is sort of the embodiment of wisdom. He's not going to change. He doesn't need to change because he's already like the God figure.
Right.
But what needs to change is that we need to change. We need to understand our impatience, our judgment, our leaping to assumptions. And that's the thing that gets changed. So Watson is the lens through which we become transformed.
Excellent. That was a great explanation of that. I've poised that question to many of my guests, and you're the first one to kind of really lay it out in a very distinct way. I'd never thought about Watson, because Watson does change. Watson's always the one he's the emotional one. He's the one that starts one way and ends another way. But Sherlock never. He's essentially the God. He's Zeus. He is Superman. He does not change.
Doesn't change. In the the archetype of the the mischief,
Loki?
They don't change.
No. I was thinking Loki mischief, but no, I know you said the comic. Yeah,
I'm thinking
trickster,
the one Forrest Gump.
Oh, got it.
Forrest Gump doesn't change. He's already got the wisdom. You know what changes? We are transformed as a result of understanding his total acceptance of the world, his compassion, his love, his open heart. That's what we're aspiring to become. He's already there from the beginning.
Yeah, Rain Man would be the same way. Dustin Hoffman absolutely doesn't change, but Tom Cruise does, and we as the audience look at it through Tom Cruise's eyes.
Right, and Tom Cruise is the protagonist in that story. He's the one that typically the protagonist is one that has the biggest change. But that's why I'm wondering, and I haven't read Sherlock Holmes since I was like 14 years old. I haven't seen the Robert Downey movies. But a lot of times there's the story where the main character isn't necessarily the protagonist. You know, think about Great Gatsby, where the story is told through the lens of Nick Carraway. Mm-hmm. Well, Nick Carraway, Gatsby, dies in the end, but Gatsby doesn't really, it's a tragic story, but we are changed through the narrator's eyes. You know, we're seeing the story through Nick's eyes. And so sometimes there's some movies where it appears that Ordinary People, mm-hmm. the main character could be argued that the main character is the Timothy Hutton character, but the protagonist is probably the Donald Sutherland character. He's the one that whose eyes become opened by the end of the story. He's the one who says to his wife, "I don't know what we've been playing at in this marriage for 20 years," and then she leaves. Donald Sutherland is – you can hang the structure on Donald Sutherland's arc, desire to – I want to bring my family together. And he can't. And the more he tries to bring them together, the more Timothy Hutton and Mary Tyler Moore become polarized. Leads to a dark night of the soul where he's sitting in the garage in his car and he says to his wife, he starts to question his wife, what the hell happened the day we buried our son? All you cared about was the shirt I was wearing, the shoes. And what's the matter? And she freaks out on him and the lights start to go on and he starts to realize that what he's wanted is to have a happy family, but he's failed to consider that he's a member of the family. And so that's when he starts to realize that until I consider myself, I'm never going to have a happy family. I'm just going to be trying to control all the external forces.
So in Shawshank, which I consider one of my favorite films of all time.
Love it.
And, you know, a lot of people think Andy Dufresne's the main character. I argue that Red is the main character. That's because Andy does change, but he is who he is. This is my own personal, and I've talked about Shawshank ad nauseum on this show because it's one of my favorite scripts of all time. But
yeah,
Andy does change because he's definitely different than when he walks in than he is when he walks out. But I don't know why I feel that his essence stays the same throughout the piece, but Red is the one that has this, I feel, even a more dramatic change from his point of view. From he was already there. He was a veteran when Andy walked in, and where he walks out at the end. Yep. I don't know. I'd love to hear your opinion on that.
Well, you know, here's the thing: I don't. It takes me a while to sort of thoughtfully break down a script and analyze it. So I don't like to give sort of quick off the cuff, and I haven't done that with Shawshank. Mm-hmm. And the way I work is there's craft, but it's also it's instinctual. And so in other words, what I'd rather address with this question, rather than sort of do I think Andy or Red is the protagonist, is I love that you're bringing up this question, because what we need to talk about with screenwriting is the holistic approach to screenwriting. I love when we look at a script like that and go, you know what, it's possible that Red is. So let's break down this script and let's see if we can hang it on Red's arc. What is the inciting incident? You know, why is this day unlike any other? And you know, I would submit that you might be right about that. That the day that Andy comes into the prison, you know, we do have Red narrating it, and that is the day unlike any other. Okay, inciting incident. That's right around page 10 of that script, I think. Why is this day unlike any other? This is the day that Andy comes into our lives and forces us to start to find the beauty within. Andy's the one that plays the opera music, but Red is the one who is allowing himself to be transformed by this external force. You've got a great antagonist in that old man.
Oh, the warden
is so. The old man who the little guy who ends up getting out.
Oh yeah,
hanging himself.
Yeah, I forgot it. Yeah, with the bird, with the crow. I forgot his name.
In other words, here's. I think, personally, a more valuable conversation for your question is I want to talk about how all of the characters in your screenplay want the same thing at nature. Okay, they all want the same thing at nature. In other words, they all want freedom. Right? What does Andy want? They all want to be free. But notice how all the characters constellate around this dilemma. Okay, a dilemma is a powerful desire. I want to be free, freedom, and a false belief. And everybody's false belief is different. And that's what makes that. So think about all the characters in Shawshank as archetypes, okay, primal forces of this dramatic question. How can I be free? Well, we do get a guy who leaves the prison and then hangs himself because he's got a misperception of freedom. His idea of freedom is the familiar. I want things the way they are. He can't accept change. Okay. Andy is a guy who accepts change. This is what makes him so powerful, is that he spends 20 years chipping away at a hole in his cell and putting a poster over it. Okay. And so he is that, that's why the ending is so moving, because it's, you know, the filmmaker flips it and we begin to understand what the movie's been about the whole time. Okay. That freedom comes from within, but we thought that freedom meant escape. Okay. The beginning of the story. So the story isn't about will, plot is will Andy escape or will Red get out or will anybody get out? But theme is about how do we reframe our relationship to freedom? Freedom at the beginning means escape. By the end of the story, freedom means I must find it within. Morgan Freeman says, you know what? I know you're never letting me out. Fine, but I'm not gonna kiss your ass anymore. He finds freedom within.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we could talk about Shawshank for another 3 hours. but so let me ask you this. So the how would you tackle, because I know that's the third part of your process, how do you tackle the dreaded rewrite? Because the rewrite is something that really does, it's where a lot of writers, myself included, get stuck, because then you start nitpicking, you start losing scope, you start getting into the weeds, all this kind of stuff. And what's your process on the rewrite? How do you approach it?
Okay. Well, I'm going to answer that in 1 second. The one I want to back up for a second, because I can't do the rewrite unless I've done the first draft.
Sure.
And remember I talked about earlier marrying the wildness of our imagination to the rigor of story structure.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what I want my first draft to, and I can't do that until I've done an outline where because the way I teach outlining is very different than everybody else. Okay. The outline, I always say that everything you imagine belongs in your story if you can distill it to its nature. Okay. So I really encourage, we got to understand that human beings are contradictory creatures. We want adventure, but we also want security. We want love and connection, but we also want our individuality. And so what happens sometimes, I see this all the time, particularly with screenwriters, is that in wanting to be a good screenwriter, we start to employ logic, and logic kills the aliveness of your story. There's nothing logical about Jimmy Stewart considering taking a job with Mr. Potter. Okay, you know, there's nothing logical about a guy who's wanted to be free his whole life. He gets out and the first day he checks into a motel and hangs himself. Nothing logical about that, but there's something so true about it, and there's something primal about it. And so in the first month of the 90-day screenplay, I keep bringing writers back to the primal. What does your protagonist want? What do the characters want? What do they all want that is the same, that's primal? Okay, it's not intellectual, but it's, I want to be free. I want connection. I want meaning. I want purpose. I want justice. I want revenge. It's primal. Once you get that outline where you feel like there is a primal drive through for your protagonist through the story, you write your first draft and you write it really, really messy. And you surprise yourself with all the crazy places these characters seem to go that make no sense. Now you've got a raw document to work with in the rewrite. In the rewrite, the first thing we do is we do a new outline. Okay. And so the new outline, you ask yourself two questions. First question is, have I said everything I set out to say? And this is where you do an inventory and you go, all right, there's actually scenes that feel like they're missing, or there's stuff that I felt like I pulled back. I just want to vomit this onto a random page. What is all the stuff that I set out to say? Sometimes you've said it all. And the second question is, have I said it in the most effective way? That question leads you to do a new outline. But the new outline is not a regurgitation of your first draft. And that's where a lot of people think, oh, I've got to just tighten up the first draft. No, you need to be willing to pretend that the first draft doesn't exist. And you do a new outline, because now once you've written a first draft, you understand your characters in a way you could never have understood them otherwise, because you've gotten them to the end of your screenplay. So you've got to get the first draft down fast. Don't rewrite half a screenplay. You got, once you get to the end, you're going to understand them, and then you're going to go back and do a new outline, pretending you didn't write a first draft, and you're going to start to ask yourself, now that I know more about this story than I ever did before, let me pretend I didn't write it, and let me start to explore the most effective way to tell the story. Let me look at, you know, when I wrote the first draft, I thought I had two or three inciting incidents. Let me start to explore what might be the inciting incident. Oh, I'm starting to see that it's when Morgan Freeman sees Andy Dufresne come into the prison for the first time. Wow, I thought that Andy was my protagonist. It might actually be Red. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. But because I'm holding it loosely and pretending I didn't write the screenplay, I'm actually open to that, to considering that. And now my story starts to take on a new shape, because I'm not trying to make it conform to my idea of my first draft.
That's brilliant. I love that approach. I really do love that approach.
Thank you.
On the rewrite. It's very, very cool. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about the craft. So I always love bringing new guests on, because with different approaches, because you never know when you're going to get the nugget that is going to hit you personally the right way. You might be hearing from this guru or that screenwriter or this process or that, you know, structure or whatever. And there's always that one thing. So that's probably one of the better ways to rewrite I've ever heard, on the show, period. Sure. So it's very, very cool. Now, how do you deal with writer's block? That's a question I ask all the time, because writer's block is, it's rough.
Writer's block. Okay. Let me get to that. I just want to address, you just used the word guru. And some of my students want to call me their guru, it's really recall that. But no, I want to say something to the screenwriters out there, because you got a lot of screenwriters watching this, is that I see this all the time, and it costs writers years of really great dedicated work, is that you are your own guru. Mm-hmm. And that I see writers all the time. They write a really great, messy first draft, and then they give it to a friend or a guru or whoever, and they get feedback on it. And the problem is the feedback, I'll give you like the primitive example would be, I really like scene 3 and 4, but I don't like scene 2 and 9. And so I'm being, you know, sort of facetious, but they get rid of scene 2 and 9. And you start to, it's really subtle, but writers tend to, we want to write something that's really wonderful and that works. And what happens is we start to abdicate authority over the thing that excited us at the beginning. You do that at your peril. That thing that excites you, that you might not yet be able to articulate, is the thing that you've got to hold on to. And so you've got to be able to disseminate the notes that are valuable to the notes that are, I especially with screeners, other screenwriters always want to tell you how they would write your screenplay. Mm-hmm. That's fucking useless, because it's not their screenplay. If you don't have if you don't have somebody giving you notes that is endlessly curious about what you're trying to express, their help can be really counterproductive,
damaging. Yeah, without question,
damaging.
How do you deal with writer's block?
I think writer's block is an absence of information, and so this is why the first month of the 90-day screenplay is, I always tell writers that we're not outlining for the first week, by the way. All we do is we imagine the world of the story. Okay. Now, this is what 3-year-olds, I got a 7-year-old, so you got 8-year-olds. This is what they do all day long. you tell me a story, they don't get writer's block. They just tell you a story. It might not make any sense to us, but there's sort of like a super logic to it. You know, when they're telling you a story, there's like my son does it all day long. He tells me stories, and so what we need to do is writer's block is where we come to a place when we think we're supposed to know something and then we start beating ourselves up for not knowing what we shouldn't be, what we're not yet supposed to know. And so there's a process of going from the general to the specific. The most general is, what's the thing that excites me? Oh, this is a story about a boy who meets a girl. Okay, I wonder how old they are. And I start to ask myself questions. How old are they? Where do they live? What do they do for a living? Why are they attracted to each other? What are their relationships with their family members? What's the obstacle standing in the way of their love? And that's going to lead to every question begets 50 more questions. That's what I call imagining the world of the story. I also give my students 6 writing exercises every day. These writing exercises are designed to connect to the primal forces in your characters. When you start to do that, by the end of 28 days, you know so much about these characters, and you are experiencing them in relationship to each other, but you're not trying to plant or graft a plot on top of these people. Character and plot are inextricably linked. A plot, it's not like a character lives inside of a plot. What makes screenplay so powerful is that nobody other than Andy Dufresne could have done what Andy did. His actions are inextricably, the plot that happens is inextricably linked to the who the character is.
Right. Yeah. Of course. You can't throw Indiana Jones in a James Bond movie. You know,
there you go.
Which, by the way, I would watch that movie. It'd be very interesting to watch. And I would like to throw in, I'd love to throw James Bond in an Indiana Jones movie. That would be a very interesting movie. But generally speaking, Indy is the catalyst for the adventures he goes on, because you can't, you know, it's time, it's place, it's who that character is. You can't write a Shawshank with Indiana Jones. Like, again, an interesting idea, but just not who the core of that character is. Make sense?
Exactly. And I think that on some level, there is, and I really think that it's a product of the way screenwriting is taught. It's so often taught by academics, and it's you can't. Just because you can deconstruct a masterpiece doesn't mean, you know, for your student, doesn't mean now the student ought to be able to write a masterpiece because they've seen that deconstruction. The deconstruction is valuable, but I think what's more valuable is understanding process. Because deconstructing somebody is going, here's the result, here's the thing that was created, but it doesn't explore the process that created it.
Fair enough. Now I'm going to ask you a few quick questions I ask all of my guests, sir. What are 3 screenplays that every screenwriter should read?
Oh, man. That's boy, oh, boy. That's a great question. 3 that everybody should read?
Yeah. And the list will change tomorrow, but refer right now.
Well, I want to just be a little bit – here's the thing, too, is that what you want to do is you want to, if you write in a particular genre, you want to become a master of your genre. And so I just want to say that I don't want to be like the guru. You should read these 3 screenplays. But what I would say is that if you write romantic comedies, you might want to study When Harry Met Sally. Mm-hmm. If you write, dramas, you might want to, study, Ordinary People or The Godfather. Or Cuckoo's Nest. So it's sort of like kind of the question you're asking me is sort of like, all right, I'm just going to tell you the 3 screenplays that I would recommend you read are Paddy Chayefsky's Network. Mm-hmm. And then I would say that was original screenplay. I would say, and it's the same year, within a year or two, as Cuckoo's Nest, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because that's a brilliant adaptation mm-hmm. of a novel. And if you read that novel and you read that screenplay, you'll see that these are 2 completely different animals. And it's a great way of understanding how a screenwriter needs to think in order to tell a story visually.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tootsie, I would say Tootsie because
that's so good.
I think Tootsie's a masterpiece. It's got like five subplots that are so brilliantly interwoven that, you know, when I read that screenplay, my jaw drops. I think it was Alvin Sargent that wrote that. And it's such a masterpiece. So I guess those would be my three. I can't even remember what I said.
Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Well, I would say that there's two businesses. There's Hollywood and then there's independent film. And mm-hmm. So which business are we talking about?
Let's do independent film because Hollywood, it's interesting.
Okay, yeah, because Hollywood is a completely different thing. And the thing is that if you break into indie film and you really make your masterpiece, which is going to be very different than a studio picture, the irony is that the studio is going to want to hire you. You mm-hmm. look at Ryan Johnson and Jeff, what's his name now that made Mud and
what's his name too? Ryan Coogler.
Brilliant. So many brilliant filmmakers who really pursued their vision. And then, of course, the studio – I mean, Spielberg's a perfect example. The studios come calling. So I love it. Let's talk about – how do you break into indie film? Read the Duplass Brothers book.
Yes.
I think it's called Like Brothers.
Yes, great book.
Oh my God, it is so inspiring. Those guys are so brilliant, and I can't give any better advice than what the Duplass brothers gave, which was they basically make a movie on your. I'm totally paraphrasing, but basically make a movie on your iPhone.
Yeah.
For $3, make a short film on your iPhone, and then make another one, and it's gonna suck, but you're gonna start to find. I think they call it your juju.
Yeah.
You're gonna start to find your voice, you know, in your passion, and then make another one, and then make a feature for $1,000 or $3,000, and keep. Yeah, I look at Joe Swanberg.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's brilliant. He keeps turning them out.
Prolific.
And every it just starts to improve. And so I guess that would be my thing is don't wait for anybody. I just shot I just directed a music video right before this. This thing, and we did it for the artist, brilliant singer Abby Lyons. She did a Kickstarter campaign, raised the money, and we went and shot it. And I'm thrilled with the way it turned out. But we didn't wait for a bunch of money to show up so we could make a really perfect. But it looks great. We had a great crew, but it didn't cost a lot of money.
Good. Good. Now, can you tell us where people can find you and your work and tell us a little bit about the LA Writers Lab?
So you can go to lawriterslab.com and that's my website. And I'm teaching the 90-day screenplay June 10th. And it's a donation-based workshop. And I make it donation-based so that everybody can – if there's a minimum donation of $250. For a 3-month workshop, suggested donation is I think it's $650, something like that. But I do that because I want to make great instruction affordable for anybody who wants it. And that's it. I teach a bunch of workshops. I teach the 90-day novel. I teach rewrite workshops. The rewrite workshops are all completely full with a waiting list. But if you're interested, you can always get on the waiting list. And I teach benefit workshops every month that are a minimum of $5 to join. I donate the money to different charities each month, but they're craft workshops. So I'll teach I've got one coming up end of May. It's on my website and it's called Unlock the Story Within. And basically it's everything we've been talking about. It's connecting to the story that lives within you so that you're able to, and it's a great workshop to take before the 90-day screenplay, so that you begin to understand the DNA of the story that wants to be told. You know, rather than going, oh, this is the story about Andy Dufresne. I gotta make him my protagonist. And then you start to read these books and figure out some conceptual way to get him to a transformation, only to discover that the transformation belongs to Red. You know, right. I just love that you gave that example.
Man, Alan, thank you so much for being on the show, man. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and sharing your method and your ways and your juju with our audience, man. So thanks again for being, and please stay safe out there. It's rough.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank Alan for being on the show and dropping some major, major knowledge bombs on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Tribe today. Thank you so, so much, Alan. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get his book and anything else, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/067. And guys, since you are at home, quarantined, locked up, like I said earlier, this is a great time to educate yourself on the craft. And I have laid out an amazing collection of books, audiobooks on the screenwriting craft. And you could just head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/bookstore. And there you can listen or read to your heart's content. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.